This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Welcome back to Such Sights to Show, an all things Clive Barker podcast. I'm Joe Lipsett, and I'm joined as always by Mr. Brian Christopher. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Joe. How's it going?
I am a little tired because we have done a lot of reading for this here podcast.
We have spent a lot of time in Midian over the last couple of weeks, have we not?
Mm-hmm.
Or trying to find Midian, I guess, is more accurate.
Well, there we go. Yeah, folks, we are fulfilling a long-held promise that we would venture into Midian Unmade, which is a collection of 22 short stories that was edited by Joseph Nassis and Del Howison. And this is basically a bunch of different writers kind of answered the call to put together their own spin on a Midian story. And Brian, why don't we start by just addressing the elephant in the room? Do you think that this is a solid collection of tales?
It is a collection of tales, I will say.
Okay.
I'm going to be honest, man. This was a slog. This one took me, and I think there's a lot of things that kind of contributed to this. We're middle of winter. I'm kind of like, the enthusiasm and the motivation for most things for me takes a little bit extra oomph to kind of get into it. Mm-hmm. I think that combined with the fact that I don't know that we needed 22 short stories about mm-hmm. this topic, especially when I feel like a lot of them, like a lot of the people were almost restricted by trying to follow the absolute spirit of the book, which was that, you know, there are monstrous creatures, but the real monsters are human beings. So many of these short stories were just different iterations of that, that it just got to be a little repetitive.
Yeah, I had the same kind of experience. I couldn't help but wondering if this would have felt better if there had been fewer stories and maybe they had been a little bit more diverse. This is definitely one of those cases where I would love to know what the call for pitches for this collection look like. You know, was it very much, okay, we're looking for stories that fit into these neat categories? You know, one is a story of an individual nightbreed and their interactions over a single evening with humans or other nightbreeds, something that maybe has tenuous ties to the book or the film. And then the other one is kind of, no, you know, go off and do your own thing, because, you know, just make sure that there's some kind of monster involved, because it really feels like you could slot most of these stories into one of those three. And sometimes that's great because the flavor of the writing is good, or there's just a really unique creature in the story. But a lot of the time I was just like, I think I've read this one before. Oh, no, wait, it's just the same concept with a different author.
And I feel like where this kind of like falters or stumbles a little bit compared to something like, say, Hellbound Hearts, the mm-hmm. Hellraiser short story collection.
Right.
Those went off on their own path so much that there were times where if you didn't know it was tied into the Hellraiser universe, you wouldn't really suspect it. And I mean mm-hmm. that in a good way. Right. You know, it's something where it's like under the lens of like, yes, you knew that these were Hellraiser short stories. It's like, okay, I see how this kind of ties into it. But mm-hmm. everything got to be so varied and different that it didn't, that sense of repetition wasn't there. And unfortunately, that was very present in this collection.
Right. Okay. I have a follow-up question then, because you brought in that other collection. Do you feel like one of the struggles with Midian Unmade is the fact that we don't love this story or this world quite as much as Hellraiser? So we were already less apt to enjoy some of the stories set in this world?
Ooh, possibly. I honestly also feel like the concept seems like a no-brainer, where it's like you have this vast like world and universe of monsters that's only kind of touched on in Cabal.
Right.
And it seems like it would be a natural extension to have something where we explore those dark corners a little bit more. But I think actually what this did was to prove that Barker really had it right in terms of giving his focus where he did and really kind of exploring this world. Like, I don't know, like a lot of what Barker does is he explores these really far out concepts with a very focused singular story. So like with the Hellbound Heart, you touch on this vast, like, other universe where these Cenobites reign, but you don't really spend too much time there.
Right.
And I think that's similar with Cabal, where, you know, you spend more time with the creatures of Midian, but you're really following Boone, who is, until kind of the very end, more of an outsider here.
Mm-hmm.
And at its heart, like, it's a serial killer story. Like, he is contending with Decker, this serial killer who is really leaning into the idea of, like, monster, or, like, humans are the real monsters.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, Barker really knows, I think, how to find the balance between these really interesting concepts, but also really leaning into a meaty but simple narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the stories in this, I don't think, found that balance. Or
right.
Each one maybe did, but reading it over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I almost wonder if this is more like, not to put it all on the editor, but like, was there not more variation in the stories that were submitted? Because this just seems like it was just like, how did you read these and not think like, oh, this is a lot of the same thing?
Oh, yeah. So I actually think you're correct in putting some of the blame, at least a little bit, on the editors, because I read a couple of different short story collections from my YA podcast, and my co-host Brenna and I have run into that a couple of times where it just feels like either we weren't being selective enough and we wanted to include as many different voices as possible, or there wasn't a firm enough hand in saying, this story reads like a bunch of other ones I've gotten and I need something different, or I need to change the call so that people understand you can tell more varied, more interesting stories than just the sort of pat and parcel. Because I agree, I think there's something to be said about how interesting the world of Midian could be, but it's also not a world anymore, right? That's the conclusion of Cabal, is that Boone effectively destroys this safe haven and the monsters have to scatter. And I really thought we were going to get more varied, interesting stories of where these creatures go. And so much of it is just generic, like, I'm in a city, I'm on a farm. Like, I think there's one that says, I'm in Australia. And for the most part, I was just like, ooh, I wonder if inherently Midian is a more interesting concept before it falls, so that we can tell what is life like for the Nightbreed when they're living there. And we do get glimpses of that in a lot of these stories. But so often, you're right, it's just, oh, and then man came and destroyed everything. And I mean, maybe I'm just not interested in biblical allegories. I don't want to look at Midian as a Garden of Eden before man becomes the serpent / apple. But yeah. So many of these stories, I was just like, I don't know. It's just a creature out interacting with humans and not having a great time. And I couldn't help but wonder, like, where are some of the derivations? Like, we're going to select a few because we either liked the writing or we did like the story. They are in there, but this made me yearn for the toll, where I wanted the good stories to be longer and more fleshed out, because I didn't just want a night or a couple of days journey with some of these characters. But instead, we keep getting, you know, 15 pages, 20 pages max, and then we're on to the next Nightbreed creature. And some of them are just not equal to others.
Yeah. 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 And I do wonder if we had had something where it was less stories, but each one a little bit longer. So like, the book was about the same length, but maybe it was only like, I don't know, 12 to 15 stories. I wonder if that would have kind of beefed up each story.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder that too. So before we go into some of our individual picks, why don't we talk about the couple of stories that do have direct ties or connections to the novel Cabal or the film Nightbreed? So we've got Sienna Maguire's The Moon Inside. So this is, I think, the very first story, which was a little misleading because I thought, oh, maybe we're all going to do characters that we know from Cabal. And instead it's like, no, that doesn't really happen. But here we actually get a follow-up story about teenage Babette, who is the little girl that gets saved from sunlight. And, you know, I think this is a soft introduction. I think it's actually pretty good to the collection, but it does set that pattern of, okay, I'm a Nightbreed. I'm trying to survive in the human world because I'm unmoored after the destruction of Midian. And then I chow down on a couple of humans and that's the end of the story.
Yeah, honestly, I do think for me, it suffered from being the first story and that being repeated so many times that it's like, I don't remember it, but I do, because I can just guess what happened. Like, it's one of the people from Midian, and they are sad because they don't have a home anymore. They find a potential connection with a person, and then it probably doesn't fully work out. And they probably eat that person. I will say, as a Seattleite, it was interesting to see something open up with my hometown. Or I guess not my hometown, my current home. But yeah, it was, I do think it was good to start off with a unknown quantity to kind of like give that entry path into the collection, in that like people will go like, okay, I remember this person before starting to get some new characters. But yeah, I think for me, it kind of, it did wind up suffering, not because of itself as a story, but just because it got lost in the sauce of just so many similar stories that came after it.
Right. And if this wasn't Babette, if you just changed the name to some other teenage Nightbreed, it would work just as well and be just as unmemorable, unfortunately.
Yeah, there was nothing that made Babette unique, like from the movie. Yeah.
No. Okay, so the next one is Sean Meeks's And Midian Whispered Its Name, and this is a story that includes Decker. So he's not the main character. We are following a Nightbreed called Caleb, and he is basically seeking out other Nightbreed. He has a kind of calling, so he ends up going to an Edmonton carnival. Edmonton, for those who don't know, is about 3 hours north of Calgary, so this would be in the same vicinity as where Sheerneck and that kind of stuff is in the book, in the film. And he ends up going to this carnival. He finds a couple of Nightbreed who are caged, and then Decker comes out and it reveals, oh, it's all a trap. And these Nightbreed have decided to work with Decker as a form of protection. So basically they're working with the enemy because at least then they know they won't get hurt by other humans.
Yeah, this one I think was probably one of the bleaker of all of them. Just it's in that dark. it is like Decker just wins, like, at least in this little slice. We don't know if he's, like, going to win the war or anything like that. But, yeah, this character, Caleb, just winds up becoming, like, in his thrall. Yeah, it was a tough one. Like, it was in the middle. I will say this, it was different from a lot of what we've been seeing, because it was, you know, it wasn't just the, you know, rinse and repeat of Nightbreed, human, falling out, bad ending. Or, you know, bittersweet ending. This had the bad ending, but yeah, it was a very different setup for that. And yeah, it was rough to read, honestly. Just kind of like watching, like hoping that Caleb is going to figure some way to get out of this. And then you realize like, nope, he's just screwed. And yeah, it was a very interesting way to bring back Decker, because they're kind of really leaning into like the religious kind of elements of like he's gathering a following, you know, and this is he's using like that very like Southern Baptist kind of like, you know, bringing people in and swaying them with his words. But I guess in addition to his words, he just has the ability to kind of like enslave their minds, basically. So yeah, it was that might have been the bleakest one of the whole book.
Brian, are you sure you're not talking about the next one, because that's the one with the cults?
Honestly, I might be.
Because this one, Decker only shows up at the end, where he's like, oh yeah, I've got these two who are imprisoned in cages. And
but I thought it was like, there did seem to be a pretty good amount of overlap between the two that featured Boone.
Okay.
I guess you're right. It is more of a carnival, but like for some reason, like even before reading the other story, my brain was interpreting it as like a televangelist. Like I was getting a televangelist feel from it.
Okay. Oh, that's so interesting. Because yeah, I definitely saw this one as a bit of a minor appearance. And then when we move into Duran Shang Welsh's The Jesuit's Mask, this one, it has Decker in it, but it's really almost more about Buttonface as its own character. Like the concept of the mask having its own voice that speaks to this character who we eventually learn is Boone's son. This to me is... It's not the best written story because I actually didn't love the narrative, but I was most taken with the concept of, oh, okay, we're acknowledging that Boone is a character and also that there have been ramifications beyond just him accidentally destroying Midian. Like this is, oh, right. Yeah. Boone has a child and he is out there in the world, maybe doing good, maybe doing bad, maybe being a savior, maybe bringing about a destruction. And then we've got this, you know, maniacal cult thrown into the mix.
Yeah. Yeah. I think both of those stories, and that's where I was getting the overlap, is like they both gave me cult vibes, like televangelist cult vibes. But yeah, okay. I think you're right. Like in hindsight, it is, I think it was definitely more of like a carnival barker vibe that we wind up getting from Decker in Midian Whispered Its Name. And then, yeah, the Jesuit's Mask is definitely more of like, you know, if you have Jesuit in the title, you're definitely getting more of the religious ramifications
there. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, and I feel like there is, well, I can appreciate how bleak they went with and Midian Whispered Its Name. I do think the discussion they're having in Jesuit's Mask, where all of these different entities are coming together and it's, you don't know really what it's coming together as. Like, is this good? Is this evil? Is this, you know, like most things in Midian, is this a combination? You know, is this an all of the above kind of thing?
Right.
So, yeah, I like the idea that in Jesuit's Mask, they do take, you know, what they hinted at with Button Mask kind of being...
almost sentient creature, right?
Yeah, but like in Cabal, it's more of like a, this is clearly going on in his own head. It's him like dealing with like two sides of himself. Here, it's much more literal in that, yeah, the mask has become sentient. You know, and I like that idea that... it's not just another aspect of Decker, and which also means like it is no longer going to go down necessarily the path that Decker wants to go down.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the fact that it's become its own thing, and then kind of bonding with Boone's son at the end, like that's just a big giant question mark. You're not left with a lot of sense of like, okay, what does this mean? Is this good? Is this bad?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I kind of like the very ambiguous nature of that ending.
Yeah, if anything, this was the story that most directly tied into Cabal, but also felt like it opened up the most interesting avenues for continuing a story. Like, I could see them doing this and then saying, actually, now we're going to launch a new collection, either of comics or maybe another short or a novella that follows up what happens at the end of this, because it feels like we're moving into a next generation kind of story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I do feel like it was a very cinematic ending too, kind of following line, like, you know, if this was going to shift into a feature film, like I could see that happening.
Yeah, yeah. It's got high potential for a really strong climax, if nothing else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so the last one with direct connections is The Farmhouse by Christopher Monfett. It's one of two stories in addition to The Lighthouse of Midian by Ian Rogers that suggests a kind of this Nightbreed is going to put down roots and open the doors and try to become the new Midian. So a lot of the stories are about, oh, I'm waiting for other people to find a safe spot, and this is what I do with my time. These two stories seem to be more about, okay, we can't wait forever. Boone isn't coming back. We haven't heard anything. So what can we do to set up a kind of new colony? And this is the one where the female Nightbreed sets up in the radio station and uses the signal on top to try to act as a beacon to get other Nightbreed in. The Farmhouse is one of the final stories. It might even be the final story.
It's the very last one.
Okay, so this is about a group of Nightbreed that are moving their way, I think, north, and they end up having to take refuge in a farmhouse. They end up turning a little boy's mother who is sick and dying into a Nightbreed, and the suggestion is that they will continue to travel, but that they might become a new Midian. And this story actually really worked for me, but I wanted it to be longer. It just wasn't long enough for me.
I will say, I think they ended on a high note. I think the farmhouse is my favorite one of the entire book.
Okay.
I really liked what they were doing with pushing the Midian narrative. I liked what they were doing where it was, like, you know, we've been talking about the repetition of, we're monstrous, but humans are even worse. It was nice to see a story that, even within the text, like, one of the characters is like, okay, we need to take a step back. And if we are looking to be accepted as more than just monsters, then we need to act like it sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, we need to give people the kindness that we want them to give us. Right. And honestly, there was something like, this was the one story that really kind of packed the most emotional punch for me. Like, I actually teared up a little bit when they were describing the exchange of this Nightbreed character basically giving her life so that this kid's mom could come back as Nightbreed. And I like that they kind of connected it with, like, there is space for both of us, to both humans and Nightbreed, to inhabit space. Basically, like, we're going to try and find a new Midian. And the only way that we're able to do this is because we have two humans who can go out and do recon for us during the day.
Exactly.
I really like that they ended on something of a hopeful note in a bunch of stories that were just, like, variations of bleak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one, you know, it still has death. It still has that conflict between the Nightbreed and humans. Like, you know, the boy's uncle discovers the Nightbreed as they're trying to make this deal. He freaks out and we just have to immediately kill him. But that seems almost less important than everything else that's going on. And the description of trying to hurry this Nightbreed across an open, sunny stretch of land between the farm and the house before the mother died so that we could turn her, it's so evocative. It feels like a tragedy because I really ended up enjoying this character. So yeah, like, this one, I agree with you. I think it's the best choice to end this compilation on because it's such a strong story.
And actually, if I remember correctly, I don't think they kill the uncle. I think he passes out because he's so scared. Okay. And right. I think that's part of the story, because it's the little kid basically assures him, like, he's not going to be a threat. I like that there's also no, like, bad guy in this one, like, capital B. Like, it is the situation that they're trying to overcome. And you get the hint that, like, even the uncle, like, they're going to be able to get him to come around. Like, he's a well-meaning dunce is the way, like, they've kind of described him. He's kind of the Steve, you know, our favorite ineffectual white man from Hellraiser. He's kind of the Steve in this situation, but he's harmless. So yeah, I like the idea that, you know, we don't have to have that person who's, like, the actual bad guy.
Right.
Yeah, that was just another thing that was a little bit, like, refreshing to end on.
Okay, well, why don't we go into some individual picks? I'm curious, how did you decide on the ones that you selected?
Oh, honestly, I think it was just things that, like, either from moments or from concepts that just stood out from the rest of the pack and had something a little bit different going on.
Okay.
Or I think, and I was going to choose one of your selections if had you not already chosen it, but I think Pride by Amber Benson. I think, you know, where we talk about the repetition of the, you know, there are monsters and then there are humans who are truly monstrous. I think she's the one who nails that the best.
Yes. Yeah. So this follows Abra, who is basically a young woman in a seaside town. She's out for the night. There is a carnival because that's a recurring theme in this collection. And she's getting scoped out by a van full of predatory rapists and serial killing boys who basically will abduct a woman, use her, and then discard the body and then move on. And of course, she ends up getting the better of them. This is Amber Benson, so I was immediately gravitating to it because I love Buffy.
Yep.
I think the writing is really strong. Abra feels like a very fully fleshed out character, even though this is very much a short story. The boys are just the right amount of jack-off, sleazy, grossos, and the violence is really excellent.
And I think there's something very interesting about the fact that Abra could have just immediately been someone who was like, oh, no, I see these people for who they are, and I'm going to teach them a lesson. That's not really her motivation. She sees possible kindred souls because she sees in these humans like, oh, they're also monsters. And I can be someone who they can like
– I can be myself around them.
Yeah, I can be myself and like I can let them be themselves and maybe they'll accept me. And obviously it doesn't work out that way because, you know, these are like it shouldn't be a surprise at this point that all roads would lead back to Hellraiser with this podcast. Sure. But like these guys are kind of the Frank Cotton of this series of short stories. Like they think that they're on this other level. But when they meet someone who truly is, they immediately can't handle it. And they are just it breaks them in all the ways possible. And it's delicious.
Yeah, particularly that gendered angle, right? Because we're anticipating it, but also we're trepidatious about it. This is one of those cases where if this had been a male writer, I think the story probably would have come out very, very different. And it's delightful because it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I really like this one. It was a lot of subversion of expectations. Even a subversion of, like, because this is Amber Benson, because it's Buffy, like, you get used to that idea of like the unassuming woman who turns the tables. But I think the way Benson did that is even different than the way Buffy did it most of the time.
Right.
So yeah, I think she did a really, really good job with that story. I really enjoyed it.
Agreed. Yeah. I think it's actually a bit of a problem that it's so early in the collection too, because you feel like, okay, we got an interesting story that's going to connect back with the Babette one. And then we go into this one and you think, okay, so we're going to get some good variation. This is what it's going to be like. And then no, not always.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So what's another one of your picks?
So my first one is Button Button by Ernie W. Cooper.
I like this one a lot, too.
Yeah. Yeah. A human boy, Elliot, bonds with a nightbreed boy named Simon. Yeah. And I think this one stood out for me because this is a variation or this is a deviation from the disappointment of possible connections that don't turn out. And this one, you know, these are two boys who are dealing with their own individual trauma and they find a way to bond over that. You know, and the button is Simon, this nightbreed boy, has been compulsively collecting buttons because of his interaction in what we learned was the climax of Nightbreed / Cabal, where Decker is on his rampage. He gets a glimpse of him in his button face attire. So he becomes obsessed with buttons.
Right.
And this boy, Elliot, who is bullied and just kind of dealing with his own kind of internal metaphorical demons, he decides like he wants to help him out. So they start getting like bags full of buttons. And so it's also an interesting twist for me at the end where, you know, one of the things, you know, definitely leaning into the humans as monsters, there's this other boy, I believe his name is Sean, who has been bullying Elliot.
Yep.
And getting like more and more violent and more shitty about it. You know, and you think it's going to be one of those things where it's like, okay, well, you kind of fucked with the wrong kid because he's got a nightbreed friend. And Simon is the one who like decides to like draw back and show mercy. And Elliot is the one who kills Sean.
Yep.
I really like that as like an inversion of some of the themes that we're talking about here. You know, Simon is the one who realizes like, I don't want to take this too far. And just as he's kind of like pulling back, the way they describe Sean getting hit in the head with a rock, he just kind of talks really about like, the back of his head basically exploding on the impact of this rock. Yeah, it is brutal, but it's also like, it's got like that beating heart underneath it that like really kind of gives it more to chew on for me. I really like this one.
Yeah, the writing is strong here. You know, this is a short story that feels contained, but also I would have loved to have seen what happened next. Like, I could have imagined Simon and Elliot almost like running away together because they now understand each other and they've been locked into a kind of pact, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We learned that Elliot, his mother doesn't understand him and she gets really frustrated with him to the point that there's suggestions that we might even begin to enter into a like a domestic abuse situation where she's a bad mother and so on. So there's a lot going on in a very short amount of time, but it doesn't feel incomplete. Like there's another short story. I didn't make note of the name, but it's about a little girl whose mother moves her in with a new lover. And the little girl discovers that there's a nightbreed living in the basement. Mm-hmm. She's kind of like a slimy aquatic nightbreed. And I like that one because there's a suggestion that the nightbreed might be luring the girl in to murder or maybe eat her. Mm-hmm. And you don't really get a sense of what's going on until the end of the story. And even then it's left up in the air. But I think of the two, Button Button is the more successful one because it still has that air of danger, but it feels like a complete story all on its own.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I did see the overlap with that other story. And just like you, the name of that one escapes me. And I think it's because this one is more successful and was a little bit more memorable for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got a couple of very masculine energy stories to discuss next. My second pick is The Devil Until the Credits Roll by Weston Oshie. And this author wrote the story while he was deployed in Afghanistan. So it is an armed forces story. It's told from the perspective of what we think is a human being who has had an interaction with a nightbreed who can basically get into your mind and torture you. So it's set in Afghanistan as this armed forces group is trying to seek it out to deploy it as a weapon. And then by the end of the story, we discover that the main character who we've been reading, Special Officer Gillum, is actually himself a nightbreed and he's been almost lying to himself in a fugue state. This one is tricky. I don't think it's going to be everyone's bag. There's really violent descriptions of like Gillum, the last time he encountered this nightbreed, he gouged out his friend's eyes and then fucked the sockets. So it's like really gross, rapey shit.
Yeah.
But I liked it because it did feel like it was really going into adult avenues. Like some of the stories almost feel like bedtime fables. And this one is like gross, mean, really pushing the boundaries of taste.
Yeah. And, you know, from what I've read, like is really kind of pulling the flat back on the shit that people in the armed forces have had to process in terms of the stuff that they had to do while they were at war.
And how it gets covered up.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's actually a little interesting for me. And I read the ending a little bit differently.
Okay.
Like either A, I missed something or B, just like variants of interpretation. For me, the ending where he is revealed to be Nightbreed, I read that almost as like, this was his becoming kind of you know, like Boone was initially human and he becomes Cabal.
I thought
this was kind of like his transformation story where he realizes like the monstrosity on the inside that has kind of been coming out during his time at war. Like this is him fully becoming Nightbreed.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot.
But I think your interpretation also fully works in terms of like, he's just been kind of lying to himself and Rook has maybe just been going along with it because he's like, he knows he's not ready yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I just really like the taunting and even the creature effects, like the nightbreed that they're seeking out in this cave. It's really memorable. And I felt like this creature, it felt distinct compared to some of the other stories where I was just like, I don't really know what this would look like or how they would act, or, you know, I'm constantly trying to picture things in terms of adaptation choices, right? Like film or television. And I felt like I could really envision how this would go down and how you could make it really visually appealing.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, even like the way he described, I think if I remember correctly, Rook like His distinguishing feature is he had like one like big horn at the top of his head, but the way he was dressed also stood out because if I remember correctly, he was like shirtless and with a kilt or something along those lines. Just something that was just very like in your face and very just kind of like confrontational and just the way he just always is. I was also kind of a little bit like not thrown, but just like it got my gears spinning because the Nightbreed here is named Rook. There's a completely different story in this collection.
Yeah.
Where the
with another Nightbreed
named
Rook, right? That's the one that abducts the woman. Well, he finds a woman who's been sexually assaulted and is dying in an alley, and then he takes her home, but then he eats her, right?
Yeah. Which then made me go back, like, was there a Rook in, like, Nightbreed? And now I think this was just a coincidence that, like, they just happened to, like, two authors happened to name their Nightbreed characters Rook.
But also, editors, what are you doing? Yeah. Because if we're reading this as a collection, then we're immediately picking up on that. Because I had the exact same thing. I forgot it until you said it. But I was about to literally correct you and say, no, Brian, you're actually confusing the Nightbreed characters. That's a separate story. No, it's just bad editing. Okay, but you have another story that has a kind of big male energy to it.
Yeah, I Am the Knight You Never Speak Of by C. Robert Cargill. And this is basically a knight and the life of a Sen Eater.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Nightbreed creature who is very malleable. You know, in this particular instance, it's very masculine energy, but they describe themselves as like they don't even really know their gender or their identity beyond how they are seen by their prey. So based off of who it is that they're going after, they could be seen as a man, a woman, child, you know, just anything that that person desires.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, he's coming across as like a early to mid 20s gay man.
Right.
Because that is what his initial prey is looking for. And it's I love the concept, too, because he doesn't feed on flesh or people or Nightbreed. He feeds on their like darkest desires. Mm-hmm. And it's the intent.
Right.
As George Carlin talks about it, when he talks about like intent, it's the you gotta wanna. And that's like what he feeds off of, that deep, dark, like wanting to.
Right.
And it's also they play with the idea that he actually gets his most sustenance when he feeds off of other monsters and their deepest, darkest desires. Like that will last him for like, if he gets a really good one, like decades.
Right.
But with humans, it's basically like the vampire version of feeding off rats. Like it staves off the discomfort for a little while, but he's got to kind of keep doing it.
Right.
Yeah. I like this because it was more, there's more of like a cavalier, like anti-hero vibe to this story where it's not really as much like brooding. Like, I don't think he is like conflicted about who he is and what he wants. It's more just like, I like the twist and turns, the cat and mouse of him going after his prey, which in a final twist is actually revealed to not be like this kind of like washed up former job chick kicker that you think it's going to be, but rather the two Nightbreed that are hiding in the house that he is going to basically use this shit kicker as bait to lure out so that he can then devour them. Yeah, this was, I think, one of the more playful of the stories, which was kind of a welcome diversion from a lot of like the brooding navel gazing of a lot of these.
Okay, so this is fascinating. I hope you're going to be fascinated by my response. I hated this one.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Why?
So I'm in full agreement with you that I thought the premise was great. I was really intrigued by the concept, you know, the nightmarish creatures of this particular Nightbreed. I could not get behind Cargill's writing at all. It opens up and it's like, you can't tell what gender I am, but you want to fuck me. And you're probably rubbing yourself right now. And it just, the energy and the tone is completely off from every other story in this collection. It doesn't feel at all Nightbreed-y to me. It doesn't try to even reflect or speak back to Barker's original writing. Like, it felt like this was C. Robert Cargill saying, I've got an idea for a really interesting creature story, and he makes no attempt to really put it into this world. So it felt very standoffish and very out of place. So as much as I like the story and even that twist that, yes, you know, I'm hungry for another Nightbreed because it's going to sustain me for so much longer, like it's an okay reveal. But this writing just did not connect with me. I could not get into the story at all.
And see, that's the funny part. Like, I think I 100% agree with you in terms of the way that, like, Cargill isn't really trying to connect with the Nightbreed mythos, and he's not really trying to get the vibe. I think that's part of why I loved it so much, because at that point, I think it's like in the middle of the book.
You're like, oh my God, a breath of fresh air.
I was craving something different. Yeah.
Which I would agree with, but in that case, I would have liked to have seen more stories that have this kind of almost more authorial voice, because it does feel like everyone else is playing to Barker or to Nightbreed Midian specifically. Like, everybody else got the same memo, and then Cargill is off here doing his own thing. And if you like that, because it feels like that breath of fresh air, I think it's really going to work for you. For me, this was just so tonally jarring. I was like, I like that story, but I don't like the way it's written.
Like, I think for me, it was like the same feeling as like when you're starting to like nod off in your hand and your head kind of drops a little bit, and like, right, oh, okay, there's something different going on here. So, yeah, I think that's part of why it worked for me. And I think, again, it goes back to the discussion of the fact that that's the only time we get that kind of like diversion is, I think, again, an editing issue where like they should have sprinkled more of that through the book.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I don't disagree with that point. I just, you know, this stands out. And for my taste, it wasn't in a good way because of that. Okay, so my next pick is Tamara by Paul J. Salamoff. And this one, I thought the writing was okay. It was principally, we've not really talked about it, but, you know, like a lot of Barker's writing, Cabal was very highly sexual, sometimes in very controversial or off-putting ways. And I felt like this story is one of the few, actually, my next one will follow in the same suit, where there's an almost like gender bending quality to it that I thought was playful, a little bit confounding, a little bit disturbing. So this is the story of Tamara, who is a Nightbreed that is really damaged by what happened in Midian. So she has not gone very far, but she has the ability to shapeshift. So she killed Daniel, who was one of the people who, I think he was like a police officer who was involved in the raid on Midian. And she takes on his body, basically. And then she goes and sleeps with his wife. And then when his wife discovers that that is not her husband, she kills the wife. And then she becomes the mother to their young child. And I thought it was just a, in some ways, very similar to what I would expect a Nightbreed story to be. It doesn't quite go far enough. I would have liked to have seen what happens next, but this is the nature of short stories. But I really like this idea of playing with gender and bodies and trying to almost unpack what makes a human being more than just a sack of flesh.
And I think is interesting, because I think this is one of the few stories where a Nightbreed grapples with their actions and grapples with like the guilt of what they've done. Because that's why she's doing all of this. She is trying to find some way to atone for, which is interesting because like within the context of she killed him in self-defense, but she 100%. Still feels like really guilty about it.
Yeah.
Which I think is, you know, this is through the lens of a Nightbreed, but I think that's a very human thing where it's like you're dealing with that idea of like it was him or me, but I still took another person's life,
right?
You know, so it's interesting to watch that internal kind of conflict, but within the Nightbreed, who usually, you know, they're depicted as like, no, we are who we are, you know, becoming Nightbreed is kind of like accepting the monster inside. So having one here who is grappling with that still is an interesting take on the mythos.
And Tamara's almost lured in by the excitement of adopting this new body, right? Like it feels good to discover what a new body can do. So she can actually hold the body for as long as she chooses. It's not like, oh, I have to transform back in a couple of hours or something. She just normally prefers her original form because that's what she's used to. But she starts to like being Daniel. But the problem is the longer she stays, the more at risk she puts herself in. But also the more she just kind of keeps fucking up the situation because she's not him. She doesn't have the right answer. She doesn't have the shared history. She gets things wrong. And then it's like, oops, I just had to kill another person. Oops, I'm now a mother. Like, the story ends on this note that you think, oh, how long is this kid going to last before she has to kill him and take over his form?
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, yeah, there's the, you know, you could kind of see this going down two paths. Like, is this like the start of a new life for Tamara, where like, okay, she settles in as the mom for this kid, or more likely, is this the start of a series of mishaps where she is basically going to keep killing people, taking over their lives, and like, this is going to kind of be her life now.
Right.
Yeah, I like that they don't necessarily answer that one way or the other either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have one more.
Yes. Cell of Curtains by Timothy Baker. Two Nightbreed, Manda and Ozlet, hide among a traveling freak show.
Yet another carnival.
Yet another carnival, yeah. I mean, this one has all the same elements of what we've been seeing for a lot of these. You know, it's two Nightbreed who are just kind of like trying to survive in the human world. One of them feeds off of other people's like erotic desires. And I think the other one takes on other people's misery, and like it's a double-edged sword because he feeds off of it, but it also like hurts him to a degree.
Right.
And
he starts off the story as like basically part of a body in a box. Yeah. And she's just carting him around.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not much of him at this point, both figuratively and literally. And I think one of the things that caught my eye on this is that it does kind of bring more of the sexual elements into it. And we talk at length about in Cabal, like one of the best scenes in that is when Boone comes into his own in that really great sex scene that he has with Lori, where they both kind of come into their own.
Right.
And come into each other. But here, you know, I think it's not nearly to that level, but who is when it comes to like, you know, Barker. But I do like what they play with in terms of like the tension between Manda and the fire handler girl. You know, you kind of have this just like she clearly has a thing for Manda. And that kind of like pull is kind of an undercurrent through the whole short story. But then to kind of have it pivot into like the story's climax where it's like the strong man who winds up having sex with Manda, but with a very kind of different ending than I think what Manda had envisioned. Like she was basically like, all right, big guy, like you want this, come have at it.
Right.
And he's, you know, doing his thing. And then Ozlet takes that opportunity to feed off of him and basically restore himself into like a strong man version of himself. I don't think it's quite as shapeshifty as Tamara, where like, I don't think he's become like a duplicate.
No, he hasn't become that guy. He's just reconstituted himself.
Yeah. Yeah. But they do mention that he is bald, like the strong man was. So like he like took a lot of those elements.
He took the juices.
Yeah. Yeah. really just sucking the marrow out. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And I like that it kind of ended on like a little bit of just like a happy note. They kind of like walk into the sunset and Ozlet is restored.
Yeah, he's just running around nude, enjoying his legs again. I also like this one. I was glad you put it on your list because I was hoping to have the opportunity to talk about it. In some ways, I think this suffers because it is a little bit later in the collection. So when it's like, oh, okay, we're living among the humans, we're probably going to eat a couple of them. It's just a matter of time. by this point, we've seen that so many times that this ended up feeling a little bit repetitive, where I think if it had been early, it would have been fresh and innovative and so on. But I liked these two characters a lot, and this idea that they've been together forever. It's almost like a monogamous relationship where they step out to feed, but they have to feed on these sexual energies. So I like the relationship dynamics a lot. This is one I wish it was a little bit longer, just because I kind of liked these two characters a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I do think it was like the two central characters, like, really, you know, it wasn't necessarily any of the narrative elements, but just the two main characters were so well written that it stood out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not going to lie, could have done with a few more female authors in this collection, or maybe stronger stories written by female, because even just looking at the list, I'm like, wow, we highlighted a lot of male writers in this collection.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I do remember, like, pretty frequently, like, as I'm reading the story, like, kind of checking, like, oh, was this a man or a woman? Another man. Mm-hmm. Okay, another man. Like, yeah.
yep. So my final story is A Monster Among Monsters by Stephen Woodworth and Kelly Dunn. This one is, it's setting up that there was a temporary Midian-style gathering of Nightbreed, so they've been holed up in this factory, but they're under threat by another Nightbreed called the Pariah. So they basically set up a trap in which they're going to lure it in, they're going to kill it to save themselves and ensure their own survival. And the plan goes horribly, horribly awry. So this main character, Himmel, he ends up getting caught in the crossfire. The thing that worked for me is just, A, this felt very cinematic. It felt very big. Like, I could imagine almost an action-style film being made out of this story. But the denouement that we discover is that the Pariah isn't actually trying to eat or kill these Nightbreeds. It's actually just looking for a connection in the way that all of these Nightbreed have been since the destruction of Midian. And Himmel ends up getting appropriated into the Pariah so that they are basically fused together forever, and it's sexual and really gross, and Himmel doesn't like it. He didn't actually want this for himself.
Yeah.
And I thought it was just kind of gross and interesting.
Yeah, while also being kind of heartbreaking. Like, this creature isn't malevolent. It's not going around trying to, like, destroy other Nightbreed. It is inherently dangerous to everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's something just really sad about that. And yeah, I think this was definitely an interesting one. It's one of those things where it's like, while they're coming up with the plan, you know, I think there's this sense of underlying dread where it's like, you know, none of this is going to work out.
Mm-hmm. It's just too simple, even though their thought process is accurate. And we've got a whole range of Nightbreed with different abilities that are interesting to read about. But yeah, as you said, you know, you just know the whole thing is going to go tits up as soon as they try to put it into play.
Yeah. Plus, if no other reason, then, you know, if you've read enough stories, like, the meta narrative becomes, if you're making these big grand plans, they're not going to work. Like, they're going to go out the window almost immediately. And that's exactly what happens. They go out the window almost immediately. you know, and I think what's additionally sad is, you know, you hope it's going to be, okay, it goes out the window, but, like, they pivot and improvise and figure out a way to make it work. And it's like, no, it's just they never really stood a chance.
No. I think one other Nightbreed gets out, but it's, you know, completely by accident.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, as we said off the top, this mostly suffers by just too many stories, too many like-minded stories. And the ones that are good, you just, it's not even that, oh, they're the right length. It's like, oh, well, there were too many stories, so they're not as long as they could be or as fleshed out. Like, I think I would have preferred some kind of compendium a la Books of Blood, where maybe there was only 5 or 7 stories, but they were all, you know, 100 pages, and we could actually develop some characters and build a world a little bit more.
Yeah. Which just, you know, raises so many questions back to your initial point. Like, what was people's approach to this? Did they have, like, you know, and even more practically than what we were talking about, did they have a page limit? Did they have, like, you know, certain things that they had to incorporate, or certain, like, word counts or something like that? Because it does, it just seems like Yeah, it seems like a lot of these stories were just like they had these guardrails that they had to stay between. And there just was not enough opportunity. Like they were addressing an assignment. They weren't writing stories.
Yeah, and clearly they were not being informed as to what other people were writing. And maybe that's just the nature of how these kinds of things come together, where you are writing in isolation and then you have to submit by a deadline. And then what we've got is what we have. And we either accept them or we reject them. But oops, a lot of them ended up being very similar to each other. I guess this is what we go to print with. I don't know. I've never been an editor on a collection before, but particularly as a reader who was trying to make progress on this in a steady fashion, you know, I would sit down, I would read a story, and then maybe a couple hours later or the next day, I would go back and read another story. It wasn't a great, enjoyable read because I felt like I was just reading the same thing over again. So if I was dipping into this, you know, oh, I'm just going to read a story and then I put it back on the shelf and come back in a couple of months and I read another one, I think it probably wouldn't be as aggravating. Mm-hmm. But trying to get through this in order to record so that we could have these conversations, not the best reading experience.
No, I would agree. And had the same exact experience. Yeah, having to do it in like large chunks the way I had to was, I think that probably hurt the overall experience.
Mm-hmm. But folks, we would love to hear your thoughts on this. Did we touch on your favorite story? Did we not even mention it? And you're screaming at us right now. We would love to hear from you. So, Mr. Brian, if people want to commend you for your selections, or maybe even say, oh yeah, definitely, that Cargill story, that's the standout, how would they get in touch?
You can hit me up at either Blue Sky or on Instagram, at Evil Taylor Hicks.
Okay. And you can reach me at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B. And of course, we will thank the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network for hosting the show, as always. Lots of great content on the feed, so make sure you're sampling some of the other shows, or maybe like giving us a rating and review. Brian and I have been doing this for about 20 episodes now over the last year and a half, so give us a little bit of love, maybe.
Yeah. This limited series becomes less and less limited, so we'd love to hear from people who have been hanging on with us.
Yeah, particularly those, you know, once again, thanks for hanging on, because I know that we probably said we were going to do Midian Unmade about 5 months ago, so we apologize.
We didn't say when we were going to do it, so.
Fair. Mr. Brian, we are going to go back to Mr. Barker for our next episode, though, so we're closing in on the end of Books of Blood, so we're going to finally finish it off with Volume 6 coming up next.
Can't believe it. We are almost at the finish line. I can't believe I will be able to say that I have read all 6 volumes of the Books of Blood.
Mm-hmm. And then I feel like we're going to have to revisit the film, even though we both seen it and it's okay, but not great. But it feels like that's going to have to happen, right?
Yeah, most likely. And by revisit, okay. In my case, visit. I haven't actually seen it yet.
Oh, you haven't seen it? Okay. Well, yeah. There we go. That's
yeah, so we definitely have to do it.
But first, Volume 6, next time.
Squad.